If Washington wants to get right with voters, it has to start listening to them.
Welcome to Beyond the Bubble. I'm Alex Rorty. I'm national political correspondent for McClatchy covering Democrats.
I'm Andrea Dresch, reporter for the Star-Telegram in Fort Worth covering the Texas delegation in D.C.
Our beloved host, Kristen Roberts, is off this week, but the news isn't. Andrea, thank you so much for being here.
Glad to be here.
What do you want to talk about today?
Let's talk about how national Democrats are once again trying to mess with Texas.
And who are we talking about this with?
Let's kick things off with somebody who knows Texas politics better than anybody, Bud Kennedy from the Fort Worth Star-Telegram.
All right, you ready to start the show?
Let's do it.
January 20th, the day the people became the rulers of this nation again.
And our ideals and fundamental values are being attacked. Do we retreat or do we fight? I say we fight.
He heard those voices that were out there that other people weren't hearing, and he just earned a mandate.
It is time for Democrats to grow a backbone and get out there and fight.
The American people would like to try something new. We would like to see the country go in a different direction to change the course for America.
He doesn't take this presidency seriously enough.
So to all Americans, hear these words. You will never be ignored again.
Hey, Bud, thank you so much for coming back onto the show. It has been too long, sir.
Thank you. Good to be here from Texas and good to be on with you and Andrea.
You know, you guys had last week the first wave of federal primaries. Happened first in Texas, naturally, and there were a lot of races. There's a lot to digest. What really struck you about the races last week?
Well, of course, I think the most talked about question was how many Democrats would vote. And the answer is that a lot more Democrats voted than usual, but nuttin' times nuttin' is still nuttin' in Texas. And there were about a half million more Republicans than Democrats in the primary vote overall. Everyone who's wondering if Texas is turning blue, you know, it's just barely maybe a slightly purplish shade of red at this point, but that's about as far as it's going so far.
Well, but I mean, were Democrats disappointed with that? Because I know with some of the early voting, there was optimism. You know, people saw that the Democratic vote was surging. And there seemed to be real talk that maybe Democrats could eclipse the primary vote. Then again, I mean, we've been down this road before. It's not our first rodeo, so to speak. You know, this talk of Texas turning blue. So I'm curious, were Texas Democrats disappointed or was this kind of expected at the end of the day?
There is always a lot of talk outside Texas from people who live in states where there is a functional Democratic Party. But in Texas, there really, and I'm serious about this, there is no statewide Democratic Party structure at all. There's a Texas party and a party in Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, and Austin. But, you know, more than half the counties in the state, the county clerk conducted the primary because there was no party there to conduct it. You know, people are saying, oh, my gosh, Beto O'Rourke only got 60% of the vote. Well, the good news is that Beto O'Rourke won the primary. It wasn't won by someone just with a recognizable name. You know, this is a state where for the last 20 years, the Democrats have consistently nominated a candidate from San Antonio who spent no money and had no campaign just because his name was Gene Kelly. He had a recognizable movie star's name. He's run for Senate. He's carried the party banner in a lot of elections. They've nominated other candidates who were named Yarbrough because there was a popular liberal senator in the 60s named Ralph Yarbrough, so anyone else named Yarbrough got nominated. They have had Kinky Friedman on the ticket. They had a candidate who was running for governor solely because he had a hair care fortune, Farouk Shami. The Democrats show some signs of beginning to have an organization in Texas, and Beto O'Rourke is the first Democrat with enough money to pull off a first-round victory.
You know, we want to talk a little bit about the House primaries, too, but, you know, I don't want to pass up a chance to talk about Beto O'Rourke. And, Andrea, I want you to weigh in on this, too. You know, something of a disappointing finish last week. He won the primary. He avoided a runoff. And so, look, in terms of the sort of simple things you have to do, yes, he was able to accomplish that. But his vote tally was a little underwhelming for the amount of attention and the amount of money that he's raised. And, you know, it raises some questions about just how much he has galvanized the Democratic Party. At least that's the way it looks from D.C. Bud, what did you see?
The party statewide is now basically the Beto Party. I mean, Beto is the money and the energy that's bringing young voters together at this point. There are people all over Texas who turned out to vote because they'd heard of Beto, but it still is this very new movement. I think it was 6 months ago, in a statewide poll, he had a name recognition factor of 2%. Only 2% of potential voters recognize his name, so he's just barely beginning to introduce himself. Now he's going to go head-to-head with one of the most formidable campaigners in Ted Cruz that the Republican Party has, and so it's going to be a statewide duel to see who can get out the most airtime and get out the most vote. There are not as many Democrats to get out, and the Democrats have always argued, that it's a turnout factor. Certainly they don't turn out as well as they could, but do they turn out enough to win over a strong Republican?
So, Bud, as the results were coming in last week, there was a bit of a strange controversy over Beto O'Rourke's name. Can you explain that for us?
On election night, Ted Cruz came out with his first ad. It was this fake country song ad, and the hook was,
"If you're gonna run in Texas, you can't be a liberal man."
But one of the lines down in it was that he changed his name to Beto.
Liberal Robert wanted to fit in, so he changed his name to Beto and hit it with a grin.
Of course, Robert O'Rourke has been known as Beto since childhood. He posted a photo of himself over the weekend at age 5 or 6 with Beto on his shirt just to show that. You grow up in El Paso, he was known as Beto his whole life. But what's odd about that is that Ted Cruz is the one who changed his name. Until he was 12, he was known as Felito. So Felito Cruz is accusing Beto O'Rourke of changing his name. And we're just already off to elementary school name calling. That's where we are here in the first week of the race.
You know, Andrew, you told me something interesting yesterday. You said that, for all the hype that Beto has received for outraising Ted Cruz, that Ted Cruz is actually raising more money than just about any Republican senator right now, too. Was there any sense from Democrats in your own reporting that they were disappointed that either Democrats weren't able to cast more votes last week, or that Beto O'Rourke wasn't able to get something like 90% of the Texas Democratic primary vote?
I haven't heard anybody express a disappointment about that in D.C. because I don't think they're paying that much attention to his campaign.
Is there still skepticism that Beto O'Rourke can take on Ted Cruz? Why ever would you think that in one of the country's most conservative states?
A lot of other targets this cycle.
Right, right. So, Andrea, as best you can, as a fair, impartial reporter, can you bottom line Beto O'Rourke's chances for us?
I couldn't possibly handicap that race for you, but I think there is a lot of skepticism among Democrats about the chances of picking off Ted Cruz. There's a good reason why you're not seeing national Democrats involved in this race of their pickup opportunities, which are really limited this cycle. They think they have a better chance in Tennessee, where Trump won by more than 20 points, than Texas, where he won by 9. Texas is just an expensive undertaking. And also, it's up against somebody who almost became Republican's presidential nominee.
Right. And for all the hype of someone like Beto O'Rourke, he's just a congressman in a state with a lot of congressmen. And in Tennessee, Democrats have recruited a very popular former governor, Phil Bredesen, one of the reasons why they still think that Tennessee is a better shot than Texas.
Right. And I do think one interesting piece of context, though, for where the left is this cycle, Beto O'Rourke is just a congressman from El Paso, and he's outraising Ted Cruz, who's raising more than any of his GOP Senate colleagues and also ran for president.
Right. It tells you all you need to know about Democratic fundraising this cycle.
Yeah, and where the energy is on the left.
Absolutely. So there was a fascinating moment a few weeks ago in the Texas 7 race where the DCCC, which is, again, the House Democrats' political arm, came out with what I think can be best described as an opposition research dossier on one of the candidates in this Texas 7 race, Laura Moser. It, dug up some mean comments that she said about moving back to her hometown in Paris, Texas. It had some other kind of standard issue research that you usually publish against your political opponents. This was kind of unusual. Andrea, could you explain to us why?
It is unusual. It's unusual because it was so public. There's a lot of ways that party committees can influence these races subtly. They can call up reporters and tell us who to talk to. They can help people raise money. They can direct donors in the places that they want. But a public memo like this, it opens you up to some pretty obvious criticism, as Laura Moser bit back.
"We have to fix our broken politics. And that starts by rejecting the system where Washington party bosses tell us who to choose. We tried that before, and look where it got us.
both parties have dealt with this differently and had sort of varying approaches over the years. The NRCC at this point is laughing because Republicans have done this in the past and they've suffered the consequences from it. They tried to work against Marco Rubio at one point. They've now adopted a policy where they very much don't get involved in primaries for that reason. So I think they're laughing right now to see Democrats deal with that.
Right. Just as the Republicans have struggled with the Tea Party, it seems now the Democrats are struggling with the quote-unquote resistance within their own party. Even DNC Chair Tom Perez criticized the DCCC. They say, quote, I wouldn't have done it.
And I wouldn't have done it because I think we're at our best as Democrats, you know, when we talk about the issues. Well, I don't believe that we should be anointing candidates. I think the people of Texas are the people who should be making the choices in Texas.
And if Tom Perez is dunking on you, you're in a very difficult position in the Democratic Party right now. But it only seemed to give her more attention in a very crowded primary.
Right. And things that we don't know are maybe that influences some of the groups in D.C. who could have lined up behind her not to do so. But the immediate reaction was a bunch of national press and a bunch of fundraising, and then she made it into the runoff. And that's not the only place where Democrats, you know, were involved in the primaries. That's the most public involvement. The only candidate they actively attacked. But, you know, they had candidates that they liked in other races, too, that I believe three of them didn't even make the runoff.
Right. You know, I'm thinking of the Texas 23 race with Will Hurd. Jay Hullings was kind of seen as the establishment pick. He didn't even make the runoff. Gina Ortiz Jones
finished fourth place.
Finished in fourth place, despite at least at one point being the fundraising leader. Now, I think one candidate who overtook him, Gina Ortiz Jones, who almost won the race outright, if I'm not mistaken, did have the support of Emily's List. She took off. But even a race closer to home, as it were, in Fort Worth, Ed Meyer was seen as, at least it was a fundraising leader and was kind of seen as a pick of the Democratic establishment. He also finished fourth.
Right. And progressive groups are, you know, there's a Bernie Sanders-based group that's active in Texas right now, and they would argue that they've done Texas Democrats a favor helping out candidates that are going to excite their base. They would say Hillary Clinton got more votes in Texas than Greg Abbott ever has. They just need the right candidates to excite Democrats to come out. So they think they've done Democrats a favor by helping those candidates.
So you have this conflict. You have a conflict between the Democratic establishment that, generally speaking, wants moderate candidates who can raise a lot of money. And then you have liberals, including a lot of liberals on the ground in Texas, who want people to be outspoken, to be bold, who can raise a lot of money through small dollar. Instead of the big donors, raise a lot of money through small dollar contributions and really excite the base. That's their theory of the case, that there are all these liberal voters who will come out of the woodwork and support a Democratic candidate, if only that they're a true, authentic liberal. Is this a clash that we think is going to dissipate in the coming weeks? Because it sure doesn't seem like it.
Yeah, it just reflects two different views that Democrats have for what needs to happen in Texas. And obviously, one applies more to statewide races than these congressional district races, but a feeling that maybe there are not enough Democrats in Texas to do this on their own, that you're going to have to win Republican voters, like the Beto O'Rourke strategy, or the idea that there are enough Democrats that just aren't voting, that if you just excite them out, that you can turn Texas.
Right. But there should be some skepticism about this idea that there are these secret Democrats or secret liberals who, if you just, you know, if you just activate them, if you just say the right things and you're not a moderate, you're not a centrist, they'll finally turn out the vote and Texas will turn blue. I mean, that seems like that's a theory that we should be a little skeptical about, no?
There is one point to make about the primary. There was a large education block vote that was organized to vote in the Republican primary against Lieutenant Governor. You know, you could guess maybe 5 to 6% of the voters in the Republican primary were actually Democrats who were organized to cross over and vote. So if you throw that 4, 5, 6% back into the Democratic numbers, they get a little bit closer. There are some Democrats here. There's definitely some more motivation among the Bernie Sanders and the progressive Democrats, the Indivisibles, almost more than there is on the part of the regular party. But you know, the question is, do they come close to the numbers that the Republican Party has statewide?
Okay, so it would seem like if there is a secret Democratic vote, it would come from Latino voters. And you know, historically, it's a voter block that has registered to vote at lower levels, and among voters who are registered participates in elections at lower levels. But at the same time, with President Trump and particularly some of his hardline policies on something like immigration, you would think that this would be the moment where they could get energized, that they finally could become this incredibly important and influential voter bloc in a place like Texas. But what do you make of that?
Well, Alex, this is what Texas Democrats have always looked forward to, predicted. They've said, you know, eventually the Latino vote from South Texas will overwhelm the Republican vote. They've talked for decades about the south of I-10 strategy, that they just want to win everything from Houston to San Antonio and south, and that will eventually be enough to overtake the state. But look at what happened. It came around and bit the Democrats from the backside in this primary, because that's where Sema Hernandez, who's from Houston, who was kind of a Bernie Democrat with a Latino surname, that's how she was able to pick up 24% against O'Rourke. And so you have the Latino surname against O'Rourke, who did well in the primary. And so the Latino voters, many often tend to, given a list of candidates are not familiar with, tend to choose a Latino surname. And so, you know, it worked against the Democrats in this regard.
I was going to say, it's probably also worth noting that this is not like a new topic for Republicans in Texas. They have put a lot of thought and effort and research into what motivates Hispanic voters there, knowing that this population is going to grow in Texas. Someone like John Cornyn, who spent tremendous effort in his own reelection race, actually beat the Democrat among Latino voters in 2014. So, you know, it's not like this is going to sneak up on Texas Republicans.
Can I just ask you guys, because as you both have said, I mean, this is something that we have been talking about for years. It's something that Democrats have put a lot of time and money and energy and resources into figuring out. Why hasn't it happened yet?
Alex, there are two things that have happened that have prevented it from happening yet. The first is that Texas continues to be a strong, successful state that draws migrants from all over America. That, you know, the reason Ann Richards lost to George W. Bush as governor, she actually got more votes the second time around than she did the first time in winning. But there were so many more suburban, middle-class Republicans who had moved into Texas for low taxes, jobs, that the Republican vote overwhelmed the Democratic. As Ann Richards said, that she made the state so successful, a bunch of Republicans moved in. And so you have the continued growth of Texas that balances the demographic change. The second reason is that the Republicans have a very systematic strategy. They have a number to hit. If the Republicans can hit 40% of the general election vote among Latino voters, then they can keep control of the government in Texas and keep control of the line drawing for congressional seats. They have that number 40. It was Rick Perry's strategy. It's Greg Abbott's strategy. It's George W. Bush's strategy. It's not President Trump's strategy, and that's what's made it a little more difficult.
Okay, so now we're on to the lightning round, where each of us will identify one politician or topic relevant to 2018 or 2020. Andrea, you get to go first.
I'd like to call some attention back to our open seat race in the Tarrant County area to replace Joe Barton, who, as you might remember, came out in favor of the DREAM Act. He's a conservative member from North Texas. There are two primary runoffs, a primary runoff on each side in that race that kind of encapsulates everything that's going on in Texas and I mean, nationally, too. You've got Ron Wright, who's the favorite for that seat, who has the endorsement of the Club for Growth. He says he would join the Freedom Caucus in D.C. He's got a challenge from another Republican who says he wouldn't join the Freedom Caucus. You also have two Democrats, one who has actually outraised both of the Republicans in that race, and another who has run in the past and is trying to build a coalition of Democrats' traditional pillars in Texas.
Okay. Bud, what do you got?
I think the one you've got to watch is Texas Governor Greg Abbott. You know, he's quietly avoiding any sort of conflict with the Trump administration, but he's not closely connected to it. Lieutenant Governor Patrick is kind of Trump's man in Austin. And what Greg Abbott won his primary last week with 91% of the vote on the Republican side. He's headed to an overwhelming victory for governor in the fall. No matter how strong the blue wave gets for Beto O'Rourke, it probably won't get strong enough to lift Lupe Valdez or Andrew White to victory. He'll have two underfunded, little-known Democrats. Probably the Dallas County Sheriff, Lupe Valdez, looks like she may wind up being the winner of the primary, but you know, she won't offer much of a challenge to him in the fall. He's got $30 million in the bank to run on. He's got positioning. He managed to straddle the sides of the party between the establishment Republicans and the religious Republicans. He's Texas' first Roman Catholic governor since Texas was under Mexico rule. He manages to cross a lot of lines and bring together a lot of coalition. And I think that Greg Abbott is one to watch on the national level in elections to come.
He is a quietly compelling figure, I think, that we really don't talk an awful lot about nationally. But that maybe is going to start changing here in the years to come. Mine is Marie Newman, who is poised, potentially, to become a liberal hero next week if in the Illinois 3rd District primary she is able to defeat incumbent Democrat Dan Lipinski. We have talked about this race on the podcast for months, actually. We, in fact, even interviewed Dan Lipinski a few months ago about it. But it looks like in the final week that she actually has a chance of winning, despite a lot of skepticism about her race. She has drawn a lot of attention. She has earned even more endorsements. She's raised a ton of money, enough money that it is feasible she can knock off an incumbent. And that's a real race to watch next week to see if the liberal wing of the Democratic Party is able to knock off a pro-life, anti-Obamacare Democrat who has held on to that district because his dad was a very popular congressman and he is a kind of old school union Democrat, the type of which Democrats really don't have much of anymore. Marie Newman, a real candidate to watch next week. All right, that's it for us, Bud. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hope you come back soon, Andrea.
Thanks.
Thank you to producer Jordan Marie Smith, and thank you, our listeners. We want to hear from you, so please send your questions and comments to btb@mcclatchy.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/beyondthebubblepod. Tell us what you're seeing in your battleground states. We might even ask you to call into the show. And check us out on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you use. We want to say thank you to everyone who's left us a review or a rating. Talk to you next week.